Well, hello there, fellow locked in, anxious, struggling human beings. This is Cory Doctorow, and you are listening to the Cory Doctorow podcast for one more week. It has been a good week. It was not a good week. God, how could it have been a good week? But we had some bright spots. And the brightest spot was that it was my wife's birthday, and I really wanted to make it special for her. And, you know, lucky for us, there had been this, like, lighted sign she wanted from someone on Etsy that was withdrawn from sale when the lockdown began, and then the seller contacted me to tell me that he was back in business, and he even delivered it in time. It turns out he lives not far from here. So that was a lovely surprise. But even better was I wrote to as many of our friends as I could find email addresses for and got them to send us pictures of themselves holding signs wishing her a happy birthday. And then at 4:30 in the morning on her birthday, my daughter and I got up and we strung bits of string all around the living room and then used them to hang dozens and dozens of birthday wishes from her friends from all different times of her life and all different parts of the world. And it was a really successful thing. And so, you know, that's all by way of saying, like, remember the people who love you and the people that you love and do what you can during this time to treat everyone with kindness and with the sweetness that we need to survive these very, very trying times. And, you know, I've been watching, like you, the horrific news from the brutal police murder of Floyd George in Minneapolis, and then the aftermath, which has been ghastly, from the attacks on protesters to the loss of institutions like Uncle Hugo's, the one of the great science fiction bookstores of the country in Minneapolis, which burned to the ground. I've been reminded of something that a mental health professional told me once when I was really struggling as a long-term relationship and a company that I'd started were falling apart at the same time. And I was far from my family, living in another country. And he said, you know, to be depressed when things are depressing is not in and of itself pathological. You can cope with it in a way that is unhealthy, but it is not in itself unhealthy to be depressed about depressing things. Situational depression, where you are depressed about things that are indeed depressing, is totally normal, and it's okay to feel that way. And so maybe some of you need to hear that right now. It's certainly something I've been thinking about. I'm going to be appearing at TorCon, that's Tor Books Online Science Fiction Convention, on June the 14th with Nnedi Okorafor. We're going to be in conversation. You can sign up at tor.com. It certainly promises to be a very good one. Nnedi is a spectacular writer and thinker and speaker, and I'm quite excited at the prospect of this. The other stuff that's happening in terms of my writing is, as you know, I've got three books out this year. On July the 14th, Posy the Monster Slayer, my first ever picture book, is coming out. It's a very cute kind of bedtime story book about a little girl who won't go to bed. Her name is Posy. She's named after my own daughter, Posy. She won't go to bed. Instead, she keeps turning her toys into monster hunting weapons and hunting monsters, which slowly turns her parents into zombies until they have a final monster battle with her. And it turns out zombies are the only thing that she can't defeat, but all they really want to do is tuck her in, which they do. And I've got really great news about this book. So originally we'd planned to have a launch a few days before the book actually came out at our local horror, science fiction, and fantasy bookstore, the wonderful Dark Delicacies here in Burbank. But of course that had to be canceled because the pandemic is on. But Dark Delicacies, they're hanging in there. They are quite an institution. You know, they publish their own anthology of horror fiction every year. When they lost their lease last year and it looked like they were not going to survive, everyone from Guillermo del Toro to Neil Gaiman to me, we raised money for them. We raised $30,000 to help them move around the corner to a new store, and they're still going strong, and they're hanging in there, I think, in part out of a sense of shared obligation to all those people who believed in the store and kind of came down to try and help them survive. You can pre-order the book from them. And instead of having a launch there on July the 11th, I'm going to pick up all of the pre-orders and some more stock as well and take it home. And I'm going to sign and personalize all those pre-orders. And I'm also going to ask Posy to sign and personalize the pre-orders, the namesake of the book. It's our first ever daddy-daughter literary occasion. So you can pre-order those if you go to Dark Delicacies and look for Posey the Monster Slayer. And they're also going to be taking pre-orders for my other books that are coming out in 2020. And I'll sign and inscribe those for you as well. On July the 7th, there's a new edition of Little Brother in Homeland coming out with a cover by Will Stala. He's the guy who did the cover for Walkaway and the re-releases of my adult novels from Tor. It's got a new introduction by Edward Snowden. And Snowden really outdid himself. He is a really just amazing writer. I'm actually just reading the young adult version of his memoir right now. I'm going to be giving it a blurb. And I was just struck anew as I was reading it today by what a wonderful writer he is. And he really outdid himself with the introduction for Homeland and Little Brother. And then on October the 12th, there's a third Little Brother novel coming out. This is a book that I worked on for about 2 years. It's called Attack Surface. It has afterwards by Ron Diebert from Citizen Lab. They're the ones who have caught so many of the arms dealers who sell cyber weapons to dictators, including the notorious NSO group. And also from Runa Sandvik, who's part of the Tor project and is a great information security hacker. And for many years, she herself was in charge of newsroom security for the New York Times and charged with defending journalists from state actors who wanted to disrupt journalists who were on to the bad deeds that they were committing. So I am so proud of this book, and it's out on October the 12th. If you pre-order it on the day the book comes out, you'll get a new Marcus Yallo story, a new Little Brother story called Force Multiplier. And I've recorded an audiobook as well as writing the book, and you'll be able to get both of those. What else is going on? Well, this week I'm going to read to you not more of my novel, Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town. I'll probably pick that up again next week, depending on what else has come out. Instead, I'm going to read to you something I wrote for the Electronic Frontier Foundation's blog, the Deep Links blog, called How Big Tech Monopolies Distort Our Public Discourse. And this is kind of a executive summary, really, of a book-length essay I wrote in response to Shoshana Zuboff's Surveillance Capitalism book, which I think has a lot going for it, but I think its core hypothesis is wrong. As you'll hear in the essay, I think that Zuboff overestimates how good big tech is at doing the things they claim they can do. And I think big tech makes those claims about being really good at changing how people think and convincing them to do stuff because it helps them sell advertising. And that's what they do for a living. And I think that one of the other problems with that analysis is that it underestimates the extent that big tech monopolies are, in fact, a way to change how we think. That the monopoly itself, having a monopoly on where people get their answers and how those answers are presented, that actually is incredibly dangerous to our discourse. And I think the problem with locating the crisis in big tech's ability to change our minds using some kind of mind control ray made out of big data, rather than locating the problem in monopoly and market concentration, is that if there is a mind control ray that you can make out of big data, then there's not really any point in trying to do antitrust enforcement. Because if you break up the big tech companies into littler companies, it'll just be a bunch of little companies with all powerful mind control rays running around. Whereas if the problem actually is the more likely of the two hypotheses, not that big tech invented a mind control ray, but rather that big tech just reinvented the same dismal monopolies of every other industry that came before it, that was allowed to grow using anti-competitive tactics from oil to telephones to grocery stores to railroads, then we know how to fix that, right? We just break those companies up. We don't let them buy their competitors. We don't let them buy their nascent competitors. We don't let them have vertical monopolies. We have a tool chest that works against monopolists. Nobody knows what to do about mind control rays. But on the other hand, everybody who ever claimed to have made a mind control ray up until this point turned out to be a bullshit artist, turned out to be lying, turned out to be lying to themselves sometimes, but still lying. And so I think that the most likely hypothesis there is the hypothesis that they're just liars who have bullied their way to monopolies and not that they are super geniuses who figured out how to take away our free will. Well, you'll hear more about that in the essay, which I'm going to read to you now. But I mentioned that this is an executive summary of a book-length essay, and I believe we haven't inked the contract yet, but I believe that has now been sold and should be out soon. It was with another publisher who delayed and delayed after accepting it, and it turned out that they were struggling financially, and a couple of weeks ago they let me know that they wouldn't be able to publish it, which was very disappointing, although I love this publisher dearly. So, I mean, my real concern is that I hope they survive and that the very talented writers who work there are able to continue to work there. But in the meantime, I'm very, very pleased that this has found another home with a really excellent publication, and I'll give you more news as that comes along. And so now, without further ado, from the Electronic Frontier Foundation's Deep Links blog, How Big Tech Monopolies Distort Our Public Discourse. Long before the pandemic crisis, there was widespread concern over the impact that tech was having on the quality of our discourse, from disinformation campaigns to influence campaigns to polarization. It's true that the way that we talk to each other and about the world has changed, both in form, thanks to the migration of discourse to online platforms, and in kind, whether that's the rise of nonverbal elements in our written discourse, like emojis, memes, ASCII art, and emoticons, or the kinds of online harassment and brigading campaigns that have grown with the internet. A common explanation for the change in our discourse is that the biggest tech platforms use surveillance, data collection, and machine learning to manipulate us, either to increase engagement, and thus page views and advertising revenues, or to persuade us of things that aren't true, for example, to convince us to buy something we don't want, or to support a politician that we would otherwise oppose. There's a simple story about that relationship. By gathering a lot of data about us, and by applying self-modifying machine learning algorithms to that data, big tech can target us with messages that slip past our critical faculties, changing our minds not with reason, but with a kind of technological mesmerism. This story originates with big tech itself. Marketing claims for programmatic advertising and targeted marketing, including political marketing, promise prospective clients that they can buy audiences for their ideas through big tech, which will mix its vast data repositories with machine learning and overwhelm our cognitive defenses to convert us into customers for products or ideas. We should always be skeptical of marketing claims. These aren't peer-reviewed journal articles, they're commercial puffery. The fact that these claims convince marketers to give billions of dollars to big tech is no guarantee that the claims are true. After all, powerful decision makers in business have a long history of believing things that turned out to be false. It's clear that our discourse is changing. Ideas that were on the fringe for years have gained new centrality. Some of these ideas are ones that we like gender inclusivity, racial justice, anti-monopolist sentiment, and some are ideas that we dislike, xenophobia, conspiracy theories, and denial of the science of climate change and vaccines. Our world is also dominated by technology, so any change to our world probably involves technology. Untangling the causal relationships between technology and discourse is a thorny problem, but it's an important one. It's possible that big tech has invented a high-tech form of mesmerism, but whether you believe in that or not, there are many less controversial, more obvious ways in which big tech is influencing and distorting our discourse. Locating precise audiences. Obviously, big tech is incredibly good at targeting precise audiences, this being the value proposition of the whole ad tech industry. Do you need to reach overseas students from the Pacific Rim doing grad studies in physics or chemistry in the Midwest? No problem. Advertisers value this feature, but so does anyone hoping to influence our discourse. Locating people goes beyond buying an audience for an ad. Activists who want to reach people who care about their issues can use this feature to mobilize them in support of their causes. Queer people who don't know anyone who is out can find online communities to help them understand and develop their own identities. People living with chronic diseases can talk about their illnesses with others who share their problems. This precision is good for anyone who's got a view that's outside of the mainstream, including people who have views that we don't agree with or causes we oppose. Big tech can help you find people to cooperate with you on racist or sexist harassment campaigns or to foment hateful political movements. A discourse requires participants. If you can't find anyone interested in discussing an esoteric subject with you, you can't discuss it. Big tech has radically altered our discourse by making it easy for people who want to talk about obscure subjects to find discussants, enabling conversations that literally never could have happened otherwise. Sometimes that's good, and sometimes it's terrible, but it's absolutely different from any other time. Secrecy. Some conversations are risky. Talking about your queer sexuality in an intolerant culture can get you ostracized or subject you to harassment and violence. Talking about your affinity for cannabis in a place where it isn't legal to consume can get you fired or even imprisoned. The fact that many online conversations take place in private spaces mean that people can say things that they would otherwise keep to themselves for fear of retribution. Not all of these things are good. Being caught producing deceptive political ads can get you in trouble with an election regulator and also send supporters to your opponents. Advertising that your business discriminates on the basis of race or gender or sexuality can get you boycotted or sued. But if you can find loopholes that allow you to target certain groups that agree with your agenda, you can win their business. Secrecy allows people to say both illegal and socially unacceptable things to people who agree with them, greatly reducing the consequences for such speech. This is why private speech is essential for social progress, and it's why private speech is beneficial to people fomenting hate and violence. We believe in private speech and have fought for it for 30 years because we believe in its benefits, but we don't deny its costs. Combined with targeting, secrecy allows for a very persuasive form of discourse. Not just because you can commit immoral acts with impunity, but also because disfavored minorities can whisper ideas that are too dangerous to speak aloud. Lying and/or being wrong. The concentration of the tech industry has produced a monoculture of answers. For many people, Google is an oracle, and its answers, the top search results, are definitive. There's a good reason for that. Google is almost always right. Type "How long is the Brooklyn Bridge" into the search box, and you'll get an answer that accords both with Wikipedia and its underlying source, the 1967 report of the New York City Landmarks Preservation Commission. Sometimes, though, Google is tricked into lying by people who want to push falsehoods onto the rest of us. By systematically exploring Google's search ranking algorithm, a system bathed in secrecy and subjected to constant analysis by the search engine optimization industry, bad actors can and do change the top results on Google, tricking the system into returning misinformation. And sometimes it's just a stupid mistake. This can be a very effective means of shifting our discourse. False answers from a reliable source are naturally taken at face value, especially when the false answer is plausible, adding or removing a few yards from the Brooklyn Bridge's length. Or when the questioner doesn't really have any idea what the answer should be, adding tens of thousands of miles per second to the speed of light. Even when Google isn't deliberately tricked into giving wrong answers, it can still give wrong answers. For example, when a quote is widely misattributed and then later corrected, Google can take months or even years to stop serving up the misattribution in its top results. Indeed, sometimes Google never gets it right in cases like this because the people who get the wrong answer from Google repeat it on their posts, increasing the number of sources where Google finds the wrong answer. This isn't just limited to Google either. The narrow search verticals that Google doesn't control, dating sites, professional networking sites, some online marketplaces, generally dominate their fields and are likewise relied upon by searchers who treat them as infallible, even though they might acknowledge that it's not always wise to do so. The upshot is that what we talk about and how we talk about it is heavily dependent on what Google tells us when we ask it questions. But this doesn't rely on Google changing our existing beliefs. If you know exactly what the speed of light is, or how long the Brooklyn Bridge is, a bad Google search result won't change your mind. Rather, this is about Google filling a void in our knowledge. There's a secondary related problem of distinctive disjunct idioms. Searching for climate hoax yields different results from searching for climate crisis, and different results still from climate change. Though all three refer to the same underlying phenomenon, they reflect very different beliefs about it. The term you use to initiate your search will lead you into a different collection of resources. This is a long-standing problem in discourse, but it is exacerbated by the digital world. Sort by controversial. Ad-supported websites make money from page views. The more pages they serve to you, the more ads they can show you, and the more likely it is that they will show you an ad that you will click on. Ads aren't very effective, even when they're highly targeted. And the more ads you see, the more inured you become to their pitches. So it takes a lot of page views to generate a sustaining volume of clicks, and the number of page views needed to maintain steady revenue tends to go up over time. Increasing the number of page views is hard. People have fixed time budgets. Platforms can increase your engagement by giving you suggestions for things that will please you, but this is hard. Think of Netflix's recommendation engine. But platforms can also increase engagement by making you angry, anxious, or outraged. And these emotions are much easier to engender with automated processes. Injecting enervating comments, shocking images, or outlandish claims into your online sessions may turn you off in the long term, but in the short term, these are a reliable source of excess clicks. This has an obvious impact on our discourse, magnifying the natural human tendency to want to weigh in on controversies about subjects that matter to you. It promotes angry, unproductive discussions. It's not mind control. People can always choose to ignore these recommendations or step away from the controversy. But platforms that deploy this tactic often take on a discordant, angry character. Deliberate censorship. Content moderation is very hard. Anyone who's ever attempted to create rules for what can and can't be posted quickly discovers that these rules can never be complete. For example, if you class certain conduct as harassment, then you may discover that conduct that is just a little less severe than you've specified is also experienced as harassment by people on its receiving end. As hard as this is, it gets much harder at scale, particularly when services cross cultural and linguistic lines. As hard as it is to decide whether someone crosses the line when that person is from the same culture as you and speaking your native language, it's much harder to interpret contributions from people of differing backgrounds, and language barriers add another layer of incredible complexity. The rise of monolithic platforms with hundreds of millions or even billions of users means that a substantial portion of our public discourse is conducted under the shadow of moderation policies that are not and cannot be complete or well administered. Even if these policies have extremely low error rates, even if only 1 in 1,000 deleted comments or posts is the victim of overzealous enforcement, systems with billions of users generate hundreds of billions of posts every day, and that adds up to many millions of acts of censorship every day. Of course, not all moderation policies are good, and sometimes moderation policies are worsened by bad legal regimes. For example, SESTA-FOSTA, a bill notionally aimed at ending human sexual trafficking, was overbroad and vague to begin with, and the moderation policies it has spawned have all but ended certain kinds of discussion of human sexuality in public forums, including some that achieved SESTA-FOSTA's nominal aim of improving safety for sex workers. For example, forums where sex workers kept lists of dangerous potential clients. These subjects were always subject to arbitrary moderation standards, but SESTA-FOSTA made the already difficult job of talking about sexuality virtually impossible. Likewise, the Communications Decency Act's requirement for blacklists of adult materials on federally subsidized internet connections, such as those in public schools and libraries, has foreclosed on access to a wealth of legitimate materials, including websites that offer information on sexual health and well-being, and on dealing with sexual harassment and assault. Accidental censorship. In addition to badly considered moderation policies, platforms are also prone to badly executed enforcement errors. Famously, Tumblr installed an automatic filter intended to block all, quote, adult content, and this filter blocked innumerable innocuous images, from images of suggestive root vegetables to Tumblr's own examples of images that contain nudity but did not constitute adult content and would thus be ignored by the filters. Errors are made by both human and automated content moderators. Sometimes errors are random and weird, but some topics are more likely to give rise to accidental censorship than others. Human sexuality, discussions by survivors of abuse and violence, especially sexual violence, and even people whose names or homes sound or look like words that have been banned by filters. Vietnamese people named Phuc were plagued by AOL's chat filters, as were Britons who lived in the town of Scunthorpe. The systemic nature of this accidental censorship means that whole fields of discourse are hard or even impossible to undertake on digital platforms. These topics are victims of a kind of machine superstition, a computer gone haywire that has banned them without the approval or intent of its human programmers, whose oversights, frailties, and short-sightedness cause them to program in a bad rule, after which they simply disappeared from the scene, leaving the machine behind to repeat that error at scale. Third-party censorship. Since the earliest days of digital networks, world governments have struggled with when and whether online services should be liable for what their users do. Depending on which country an online provider serves, they may be expected to block or preemptively remove copyright infringement, nudity, sexually explicit material, material that insults the royal family, libel, hate speech, harassment, incitements to terrorism or sectarian violence, plans to commit crimes, blasphemy, heresy, and a host of other difficult-to-define forms of communication. These policies are hard for moderation teams to enforce consistently and correctly, but that job is made much, much harder by deliberate attempts by third parties to harass or silence others by making false claims about them. In the simplest case, would-be censors merely submit false reports to platforms in hopes of slipping past a lazy or tired or confused moderator in order to get someone barred or their speech removed. However, as platforms institute ever finer-grained rules about what is and is not grounds for removal or deletion, trolls gain a new weapon, an encyclopedic knowledge of those rules. People who want to use platforms for good faith discussions are at a disadvantage relative to rules lawyers who want to disrupt the discourse. The former have interests and jobs about which they want to communicate. The latter's interest and job is disrupting the discourse. The more complex the rules become, the easier it is for bad faith actors to find in them a reason to report their opponents, and the harder it is for good faith actors to avoid crossing one of the rule set's myriad lines. Conclusion. The idea that big tech can mold discourse through bypassing our critical faculties by spying on and analyzing us is both self-serving, inasmuch as it helps big tech sell ads and influence services, and implausible, and should be viewed with extreme skepticism. But you don't have to accept extraordinary claims to find ways in which big tech is distorting and degrading our public discourse. The scale of big tech makes it opaque and error-prone, even as it makes the job of maintaining a civil and productive space for discussion and debate impossible. Big tech's monopolies, with their attendant lock-in mechanisms that hold users' data and social relationships hostage, remove any accountability that might come from fear that unhappy users might switch to a competitor. The emphasis on curbing big tech's manipulation tactics through regulatory measures has the paradoxical effect of making it much more expensive and difficult to enter the market with a big tech competitor. A regulation designed to curb big tech will come with costs that little tech can't possibly afford, and it becomes a license to dominate the digital world, disguised as a regulatory punishment for lax standards. The scale and dominance of tech firms results in unequivocal, obvious, toxic public discourse. The good news is that we have tools to deal with this: breakups, merger scrutiny, limits on vertical integration. Perhaps after big tech has been cut down to size, we'll still find that there's some kind of machine learning mesmerism that we'll have to address. But if that's the case, our job will be infinitely easier when big tech has been stripped of the monopoly rents that it uses to defend itself from attempts to alter its conduct through policy and law. All right then, everyone. Hang in there. Stay safe. Wash your hands. Fuck Trump. Talk to you next week.
You've been listening to the Cory Doctorow Podcast, licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Sharealike US 3.0. Or as Woody Guthrie put it in another context, this song is copyrighted in the US under Seal of Copyright 154085 for a period of 28 years, and anyone caught singing it without our permission will be a mighty good friend of ourn, because we don't give a dern. Publish it, write it, sing it, swing to it, yodel it, we wrote it, that's all we wanted to do. Many thanks to John Taylor Williams for mastering. That's Ryneck Studio, WRYNECK Studio at gmail.com. John Taylor Williams is a full-time self-employed audio engineer, producer, composer, and sound designer. In his free time, he makes beer, jewelry, odd musical instruments, and furniture. He likes to meditate, to read, and to cook. Talk to you next week.